This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Fatal Vision by Joe McGinnis. Read by Fred Sanders with Corey Brill. Author's Note. In the interest of protecting the privacy of individuals whose real identities are not central to the true story told here, certain names and other descriptive details have been altered in several instances. Acknowledgements. Through 15 years and 5 books, the one constant in my professional life has been my agent, Sterling Lord, for his grace, strength, ingenuity, and generosity during the particularly trying period which encompassed the composition of this work. I would like to thank him. For her immense confidence, her extraordinary and infectious enthusiasm, and her considerable editorial skills, I would like to thank Phyllis Gran of G.P. Putnam's Sons, without whom, it is entirely possible, this book would never have come to fruition. In addition, for the most capable and conscientious job of copy editing ever done on a manuscript of mine, as well as for patience and forbearance far beyond the call of duty, I would like to express gratitude to David Frost. The author would also like to express thanks to the Edward J. Doherty Foundation for its generous financial assistance, and to those officials of the U.S. government who, in compliance with the Freedom of Information Act, made available various materials which proved to be of considerable use. For Nancy. The Ballad of the Green Berets. Fighting soldiers from the sky, fearless men who jump and die, men who mean just what they say, the brave men of the Green Beret. Silver wings upon their chests, these are men, America's best. 100 men will test today, but only 3 win the Green Beret. Trained to live off nature's land, trained to combat hand to hand, men who fight by night and day, courage take from the Green Beret. Silver wings upon their chests, these are men, America's best. 100 men will test today, but only 3 win the Green Beret. Back at home, a young wife waits. Her Green Beret has met his fate. He has died for those oppressed, leaving her this last request. Put silver wings on my son's chest. Make him one of America's best. He'll be a man they'll test one day. Have him win the Green Beret. Is this a dagger which I see before me, the handle toward my hand? Come, let me clutch thee. I have thee not, and yet I see thee still. Art thou not fatal vision, sensible to feeling as to sight? Or art thou but a dagger of the mind, a false creation, proceeding from the heat-oppressed brain? Macbeth, Act 2, Scene 1, Line 33. Introduction. He's full of fun, plus noise and vim. There's really no one quite like him. Inscription beneath Jeffrey Robert McDonald's high school yearbook photograph. I first met Dr. Jeffrey McDonald in Huntington Beach, California, on a hot and cloudless Saturday morning in June of 1979. He was living in a $350,000 condominium just off the Pacific Coast Highway, 50 miles south of Los Angeles, and 10 miles from St. Mary's Hospital in Long Beach, where he served as director of emergency medicine. There were parking spaces for cars in front and boats in back, and Dr. McDonald had one of each. In his driveway, a rare Citroën Maserati with JRM MD license plates, and docked just behind the sliding glass doors of his living room, a 34-foot yacht, the recovery room. He was 35 years old, 5 feet 11 inches tall, well-muscled and deeply tanned. He wore a tight-fitting short-sleeved shirt. He had a strong handshake and a quick smile. There were gold rings on his fingers, a gold watch on his wrist, and a gold chain around his neck. His blonde hair was just beginning to turn gray. At Patchogue High School on Long Island, he had been president of the student council, quarterback of the football team, and king of the senior prom. His graduating class had voted him not only most popular, but also most likely to succeed. He had attended Princeton University and the Northwestern University Medical School. His internship year had been spent at the Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center in New York City. Upon its completion, he had enlisted in the Army and had volunteered to serve as a Green Beret. It had been almost 10 years since his wife and two daughters had been murdered in the family apartment at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and he had first been accused of killing them. In less than a month, he would be returning to North Carolina to stand trial. He took me to eat at a little restaurant just down the highway from where he lived. The Citroen Maserati handled the trip comfortably without being extended much past second gear. We sat at a large table outside, surrounded by fresh flowers and hanging plants. The waitresses made a fuss over Dr. McDonald. He was apparently a regular, and he in turn administered hugs and dispensed free medical advice. He ordered for both of us a lavish Los Angeles-style brunch. Fresh juice, fresh melon, huevos rancheros, fried potatoes, coffee, white wine. He said the trial would be held in federal court in Raleigh, North Carolina. From the start, he had claimed that the murders had been committed by a band of Manson-like intruders who had burst into the apartment in the middle of the night, in February 1970, stabbing him and knocking him unconscious, and then slaughtering his pregnant wife and two young daughters. The Army had cleared him of all charges 9 months after the crimes, following the longest pre-court-martial hearing in military history. But his dead wife's stepfather, at first his most impassioned defender, had turned bitterly against him, McDonald said, and it hounded him throughout the years that followed. After a 1975 indictment, the charges had been dismissed, this time by a federal appeals court, on grounds that he had already been denied his constitutional right to a speedy trial. But the U.S. Supreme Court had recently vacated that ruling, clearing the way for the impending trial, which would be, McDonald said, an obscene charade. "It's inconceivable to me," he said over a second pot of coffee, "that more than 9 years after the night my family was killed and I came so close to being killed myself, I can still pick up a newspaper and see myself called a murder suspect in the headlines. My only consolation is that in a few weeks it will finally be over. For 9 years I've been haunted, both by the loss of my family and by this ridiculous accusation that for some reason I killed them myself. The normal assumption might be that this is the sort of thing that gets easier with time. Well, I'll tell you something. It doesn't. It's always there. You speak at a medical conference, and it's there. You ask a girl out, and it's there. You wonder, how much does she know? How much should I tell her on the first date? And for the past 3 months, knowing it would definitely come to trial, I've been under more stress than at any time since 1970. I'm not sleeping. I'm not eating well," he pointed to his half-empty plate. "I'm showing irritability at work. It's going to be a terrible ordeal to go back there, to relive the whole thing. But at this point, in a way, I'm almost looking forward to the trial. Maybe this will finally clear the air." After the meal, Jeffrey McDonald took me back to his condominium. There was a jacuzzi just off his master bedroom, wall-to-wall carpeting, a lot of glass. Glass-topped tables, sliding glass doors, and large mirrors lining the walls. I had never before been in a home in which such a large percentage of wall space had been given over to mirrors. Hot sunlight shimmered on the water beyond the dock, but air conditioning kept the interior of the condominium cool. He poured me a glass of fruit juice and asked if I would like to go with him to North Carolina in order to write a book about the case. For years, he said, he had resisted such an idea, refusing all who had approached him with book or movie proposals. Publicity of any sort in regard to the deaths of his wife and daughters caused him pain. He had struggled hard to put the past behind him and leave it there. But now that this would no longer be possible, now that his nightmare finally was building toward its climax, he'd changed his mind. He was frustrated. He was angry. He felt abused by the judicial process. Perhaps, after all, it was time for the full story to be told. A few days later, I received an invitation to a party. It had been sent by the Long Beach Police Officers Association. Dear friend, as you may already know, the time is drawing near for the trial of Jeffrey R. McDonald versus the U.S. A group of Jeff's friends has organized in an effort to lend both financial and emotional support during this crucial time. We have planned a dinner, a dance, and raffle as a means of showing our support. The date to remember is June 18th, a Monday. There will be a sumptuous gourmet dinner at Bogart's in Marina Pacifica beginning at 7 p.m. And to round out the evening, there will be a dance in Bogart's Disco beginning at 8 p.m. Tickets for the dinner are $100 per person, which includes admission to the disco. For those who are able to give more, there will be a golden circle table, seating with Jeff, for $500 per person, which also includes admission to the disco. During the dance, there will be a lively auction of unusual, one-of-a-kind items and services. Bring your checkbook. We will also draw and announce the winner of the Hawaii vacation for two. The evening promises to be filled with good friends, good fun, good feelings. So please circle June 18th on your calendar and help us send Jeff back to North Carolina on an emotional high. It was a perfectly lovely evening in every way. The food was superb. Fine wines were available, and at the Golden Circle table, there was no shortage of champagne. For $3, one could even purchase a bright yellow bumper sticker which said, "Free the Fort Bragg One." Everyone to whom I spoke, doctors, policemen, former girlfriends, even an old Princeton roommate, exuded admiration and affection for Dr. McDonald. Superlatives were the order of the night. He was the best and the brightest, the strongest and gentlest, the most loving and most worthy of love. Everyone thought the world of Jeff. He seemed almost too good to be true. I watched as the subject of this intense adulation moved slowly from table to table, chatting easily, smiling often, his new girlfriend, Candy Kramer, glowing softly at his side. She was 22, blonde and cheerful, and just launched on her career as an airline stewardess. Dressed in an impeccably tailored cream-colored suit and charming everyone in his path, McDonald had about himself something of the aura of Robert Redford in The Candidate, with perhaps faint, distinct echoes of Gatsby. In addition to directing the 14-doctor group that handled all emergency services for St. Mary's, he was an instructor at the UCLA Medical School, author of a forthcoming textbook on emergency medical techniques, founder and director of the first Long Beach Paramedical Squadron, medical director of the Long Beach Grand Prix Auto Race, past president of the Southern California chapter of the Heart Association, the first person ever granted honorary lifetime membership in the Long Beach Police Officers Association, and a nationally known lecturer on the subject of recognition and treatment of child abuse. Whichever he was, victim or killer, and there did not seem to be a middle ground, Jeffrey McDonald had clearly succeeded in putting a great deal of time and space between himself and the events of February 17th, 1970. In the lotus land of Southern California, he had insulated himself behind layer upon layer of wealth, prestige, creature comfort, and professional accomplishment. Yet now, Across all that time and space, the past had reached out to claim him. From almost a decade ago, from 3,000 miles away, voices were calling him back. Back to the darkest hours of a cold and rainy February night, and to the cramped little apartment at 544 Castle Drive, in which his wife and daughters had lived the final, terrible moments of their lives. Jeffrey McDonald had no choice. He had to go. Even before they raffled off the trip to Hawaii, I had decided to go with him. Back to North Carolina to live with him during the trial. And then, perhaps, further back, into the past, along whatever tangled paths I might discover, to wherever it was they might lead. Part 1. The Shadow of Death. Let that day be darkness. Let not God regard it from above, neither let the light shine upon it. Let darkness and the shadow of death stain it. Let a cloud dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. As for that night, let darkness seize upon it. Let it not be joined unto the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Job, verse 3, lines 4 to 6. Chapter 1. On May 31st, 1963, from her mother and stepfather's apartment overlooking Washington Square in New York City, Colette Stevenson, who was 20 years old and had just completed her sophomore year at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, New York, wrote a letter to her boyfriend, Jeffrey McDonald, who was about to finish his second year at Princeton. My darling, just a short note to tell you what I could say briefly, i.e., I need you, and something which will take a lifetime to say, I love you. Whenever I get depressed here or impatient to do something, I take out some of your letters. Then I realize that any boredom now of mine, any spur-of-the-moment ideas about jumping on a bus to see you, are important now, because I'm not with you, but with all this summer and all our lives, I can at least leave you alone long enough to get some good marks on your exams. It's just that knowing you were so close, only an hour and a half away, it's much worse than being at Skidmore. You are so close, but I don't want to come down. I do want to come down, but I can't let my selfishness get the best of me this time. I rationalize and say it won't be long, but darling, that doesn't help, because I miss you until I am in your arms again. This might sound a little blunt coming from your shy, demure girlfriend, but at this exact moment, I wish I had my tongue in your mouth. I wish I could be with you, loving you with every part of myself. I miss you, sweetheart, so much. I've been thinking a lot about this summer and about riding in a car with you again and being with you again and loving you still, yet, forever. And I'm getting excited. Oh, by the way, at the risk of sounding very ultra-redundant again, I adore you. Yours forever, Colette. P.S. Hope your tests are going okay. I'm thinking of you all day, every day. P.P.S. You've just got to read Lord of the Flies. It was really great. She got pregnant that summer, and they were married in September in a small Catholic church in Greenwich Village. She dropped out of Skidmore, and they rented a house in Princeton, where Kimberly, their first daughter, was born in April of 1964. He left Princeton at the end of his junior year to enroll in medical school. Their second daughter, Kristen, was born during his third year at Northwestern. He completed his internship in June of 1969 and was inducted into the Army on July 1st. In September, following a physician's basic training course at Fort Sam Houston, Texas, and paratroop training at Fort Benning, Georgia, he was assigned to duty as a medical officer at Green Beret Headquarters, Fort Bragg. Colette and the children joined him there. they moved into a little garden apartment at the end of a row of garden apartments in a married officer's housing area known as Corregidor Courts. The address was 544 Castle Drive. At Christmas, in a card sent to friends from Northwestern, Colette said, "We are having a great, all-expense-paid vacation in the Army. It looks as if Jeff will be here in North Carolina for the entire 2 years, which is an immense load off my mind, at least. Life has never been so normal, nor so happy. Jeff is home every day at 5, and most days even comes home for lunch. By the way, been having such a good time lately that we are expecting a son in July." It rained in Fayetteville, North Carolina, on the night of Monday, February 16, 1970, and into the early hours of Tuesday morning. It had been raining off and on for a week, a cold, demoralizing February rain, which had turned the sandy soil muddy, but which had brought no new life to the brown winter grass. At Fort Bragg, situated less than 10 miles from downtown Fayetteville, the night had begun uneventfully. The military police patrol assigned to the Corregidor Courts housing area had responded to only one call since coming on duty at 11:30 p.m., and that had been from a captain having trouble with his oil burner. At least half a dozen times, the two-man patrol had driven past 544 Castle Drive and had neither seen nor heard anything out of the ordinary. On a Monday night in February, the combination of cold and rain apparently was enough to have kept the streets almost deserted. Then, at 3:40 a.m., a Fayetteville telephone operator received a call from a man who asked in a very faint voice that the military police and an ambulance be sent to 544 Castle Drive. "Is that on post or off post?" the operator asked. She did not receive an answer to her question. Instead, there was only silence on the line. She put the call through to MP headquarters at Fort Bragg. At 3:42 a.m., a desk sergeant heard the caller say, "544 Castle Drive. Help. 544 Castle Drive. Stabbing." Then, apparently, the caller dropped the phone. The sergeant heard a clunking noise, as if the receiver had hit a wall or floor. For 30 seconds, maybe 60, there was silence. Then the caller was back, speaking this time in a voice that the sergeant described as almost too weak to be a whisper. 544 Castle Drive. Stabbing. Hurry. Again, there was only silence on the line. Within 10 minutes, there were a dozen military policemen at the scene, milling about on the front steps or standing on the walk that led up to the house. The red lights and blue lights of their jeeps and patrol cars flashed in the raw and misty darkness. The front door was locked. The blinds were drawn. Inside, the house seemed dark and silent. A lieutenant knocked. There was no response. He knocked harder. One MP suggested that they break down the door. The lieutenant said no. This was, after all, an officer's residence. He tried once more, banging as hard as he could. Then he started back toward his car, thinking he would call the provost marshal to ask about obtaining a search warrant. On his way, he said, "Somebody check the back door." A sergeant trotted around the side of the house. Two other MPs started to follow. They were only halfway around, however, and the lieutenant was only halfway to his car when they met the sergeant coming back. He was no longer trotting, but running now as fast as he could. "Tell them to get Womack ASAP." Womack is the name of the Fort Bragg hospital. ASAP is a military acronym that means as soon as possible. In this context, it meant emergency. The back door was open, though a screen door outside it was closed. The rear entrance led through a small utility room into the master bedroom. Colette McDonald, who was 26 years old at the time of her death, lay on her back, legs apart, on the floor next to the bed. One eye was open, one breast exposed, and one arm was extended over her head. She was covered with blood. A torn and blood-stained blue pajama top had been draped across part of her chest. Her own pajamas, which had been pink, were dark with blood. Her face and head were battered and covered with blood, and more blood had soaked, perhaps still was soaking, into the rug on which she lay. Her husband, Captain Jeffrey R. McDonald, M.D., also 26, lay next to her, motionless. He wore only blue pajama bottoms. He was face down with his head on her chest and one arm wrapped around her neck. Just like with a girlfriend, an MP sergeant described it later, as if he was crying on her shoulder. A small paring knife lay on the rug near a dresser. A bedspread and sheet, saturated with blood, lay rumpled together near the doorway that led to the hall. On the headboard of the double bed, in letters 8 inches high, the word pig had been written in blood. Jeffrey McDonald began to moan. An MP ran to his side. "Check my kids," McDonald whispered. "I heard my kids crying." An MP ran down the hall. He took 2 steps inside a darkened bedroom on his left. He shined his flashlight on the bed. Kimberly McDonald, 5 years old, lay on her left side. The covers were pulled up to her shoulders and tucked beneath her. Blood covered her mattress and pillow. There was a large wound through which bone protruded on her cheek. There were also a number of gaping stab wounds in her neck. The MP backed quickly out of the room and stepped to a doorway on the opposite side of the hall. Shining his light on the bed in that room, he saw the body of an even smaller child. Kristen McDonald, 2 years old, also lay on her left side. Her left arm was outstretched. A nearly empty baby bottle lay next to her mouth. A large stuffed dog stood near the bed, its wide-eyed face pointed toward her. Her blonde hair, her head, and her face were unmarked, but she had been stabbed many times in the chest and back. Her pajamas, sheets, and mattress were soaked with blood, and more blood had run down the side of her bed to form a large pool on the floor. Leading away from this pool, toward the doorway, was a footprint in blood that appeared to have been made by the bare foot of an adult human being. In the master bedroom, Jeffrey McDonald was trying to speak. "Four of them," she kept saying. "Acid is groovy. Kill the pigs." He seemed to be laboring for breath. "Why did they do this to me? I can't breathe. I need a chest tube." He was shivering. His teeth were chattering. His muscles seemed to tighten as he shook. Suddenly, his eyes closed and he went limp. A military policeman began to administer mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. McDonald revived. He began struggling, trying to push the MP away. "I've got to check my kids." "Don't worry, sir. Someone is down there taking care of them." "Fuck me. I gotta see my kids. Take care of my kids. Leave me alone." He pushed harder and raised himself to a sitting position. Then he looked down at the body of Colette. "Jesus Christ," he cried. "Look at my wife." Then he mumbled, "I'm gonna kill those goddamn acid heads. I don't know why in the hell I fuck with them. I'm not gonna help them anymore." There had been 4 of them, McDonald told the MPs. 2 white men, 1 black, and a woman with long blonde hair, who had been wearing a floppy hat and high boots and who had been holding a candle. He also told the military police that he was a doctor, and he had been stabbed, and he thought he was going into shock. If that happened, he said, they should elevate his legs and keep him warm and make sure he did not swallow his tongue. an ambulance arrived. Two medics wheeled a stretcher through the living room and down the hallway to the bedroom. McDonald was placed on the stretcher. As he was being wheeled back down the hall, past the bedroom of his older daughter, Kimberly, he suddenly reached out, grabbed the edge of the doorway, and struggling hard against the two medics and a military policeman, managed to pull himself halfway off the stretcher. "Goddamn MPs," he shouted. "Let me see my kids." With some difficulty, the MP and the medics restrained him. They then proceeded through the hallway, down the two steps that led to the living room and out the front door of 544 Castle Drive. Once outside, Jeffrey McDonald lay quietly. His eyes were closed and a sheet was pulled up to his chin. He was wheeled quickly down the front walk, through the chilly, misty darkness, past a small group of neighbors that had gathered, and toward the flashing lights of the waiting ambulance.
The voice of Jeffrey McDonald. I can still remember when I first met Colette. We were in eighth grade, in the junior high school on South Ocean Avenue in Patchogue, and she was walking down the hallway with her best friend, June Desser. June was thin, taller than Colette, very attractive, but I thought Colette was more attractive, much softer appearing. She had a sort of vulnerable look. I was standing in the doorway of my home room up on the fifth floor, the highest floor of the Patchogue Junior High School, and they walked past, and Colette turned around and looked at me, and I looked back, and they just kept going. But I had the distinct impression, that I can still see today, that she was interested and wanted to say hello, but she was a little hesitant or tentative about doing so. I remember then, for about a week, I kept trying to find out who was the good-looking blonde who was always with the other blonde. Some people told me they were sisters, and some people told me they weren't. But they had their reputation of being kind of aloof, and Colette, of course, was from a reasonably wealthy family by Patchogue standards, and they were considered kind of upper class, and I really couldn't seem to find out that much about her. Anyway, I met her again like 2 weeks later, in passing, and eventually I found out what her full name was, and where her homeroom was, and we met on and off in hallways, and I believe in one class, I finally had her in either a history or an English class, and we started talking, and eventually I found out where she lived, and I drove my bicycle over to her house one day, and we met that way. Those were seemingly, in retrospect, now, painful times. Driving past her house on a bicycle until she noticed you, and then she'd call you over, and you'd stand outside and talk in kind of a confused fashion, not trying to be forward or aggressive, but trying to talk to her and get to meet her and know her better, and this would go on for hours. The person she lived next to was Timmy Cohane. He was a kid who'd had polio and a weakened leg with a brace, and he was one of Colette's best friends. I ended up becoming a good friend of his, too. And we used to go out and play basketball together at his house, but a lot of the reason I was over there was so I could end up seeing Colette. She would come over and sit on the fence, and we eventually struck up this relationship, and I ended up asking her out to the movies. It was either in the last part of eighth grade or the first part of ninth grade that we went to the Rialto Theater and sat in the balcony and held hands and watched A Summer Place with Troy Donahue, and I think the blonde was Connie Stevens. We sat through it twice because we were so stunned by its beauty, and it was always sort of our movie. Colette and I always felt that we were those two people falling in love. It was a beautiful thing to us in ninth grade. And that song, Theme from a Summer Place, was always a very good song for us. We fell in love to that song, and whenever we heard it, it was, you know, a tremendous reminiscence. It was a tiny bit melancholy, as all love songs are to young people when they're falling in love, but it was a good melancholy, and we always, either of us, would turn up the radio when that song came on. Now, of course, still to this day, when I hear that song, I get this big flood of sadness and nostalgia, and Colette and warm eyes, and her blonde hair, and her warmth, and me holding her in the theater as a ninth grader.
Chapter 2. In the ambulance, on the way to the hospital, Jeffrey McDonald told the attendant that he needed fluids, that he was going into shock, that he was about to pass out. He spoke again of the attack. The female intruder had said, "Groovy, hit him again." He also spoke briefly of his wife. She had called out, "Help me, Jeff! Help me, Jeff!" he said. But he had been attacked before he was able to get to her. Then he exclaimed, "My God! She was pregnant!" In the emergency room, an orderly placed a Vaseline gauze bandage over a small wound in the right side of McDonald's chest, through which blood was bubbling. That was the only injury which seemed to require immediate attention. He wanted to know where his family was, the orderly would tell investigators. Why weren't they here? He mentioned something about two Negro males, one white male and one female. She was wearing a white hat and white boots. She was carrying a candle and she was saying, "Acid is groovy," and "Kill the pigs." According to the orderly, McDonald said the intruders had been wearing hippie-style clothing. He said he woke up in the hallway and could see his wife, and she had a knife sticking out of her chest, and he crawled over to her, and he said he pulled the knife out and saw that she wasn't breathing. He said the children were saying, "Daddy, Daddy." Then he said, "Why would they do this to my wife? She never hurt anyone." The doctor on duty in the emergency room made a quick examination and noted three injuries in addition to the chest wound. A bruise on the left side of the forehead, the skin of which was not broken, and superficial stab wounds of the abdomen and upper left arm. None of McDonald's wounds required stitching. His blood pressure was 120 over 70, his pulse 78, respiration rate 26, and temperature 99, all considered normal vital signs. The emergency physician gave him no treatment at all. In listening to McDonald's chest, however, the doctor noted decreased breath sounds on the right side, indicating the possibility of a partially collapsed lung, a diagnosis which was confirmed by chest X-ray. Of far more concern than his physical condition was McDonald's emotional status. He was both tearful and angry during his first moments at the hospital and seemed agitated to the point of hysteria. Screaming and cursing, he berated a nurse who approached to ask his social security number, and there was concern that he might jump up from the litter upon which he'd been placed, just as, pushing and swearing, he had tried to struggle free of the military police and medics who had wheeled him out of 544 Castle Drive. "Am I going to be all right, Doc? Am I going to be all right?" McDonald asked the emergency physician. "Yes," said the doctor, "I think you are." "What about my wife and kids?" The doctor, who already had been informed that this patient's family had just been murdered, did not want to upset him any further. "They'll be okay," the doctor said. "What do you mean, they'll be okay?" McDonald said. "They're dead, aren't they?" The second doctor to examine McDonald was the surgical resident on duty, Benjamin Klein. He observed the same injuries that the first doctor had, and, in addition, noted on the left side of the chest, four puncture-type wounds along a linear track, spaced rather evenly, about 2 to 3 millimeters apart. The military policeman who had given McDonald mouth-to-mouth resuscitation had observed the same marks. To him, they had appeared to be scratches, like where someone had dug their nails into him. Repeatedly, McDonald asked why his wife and children had not been brought to the hospital. "Why aren't they here yet? How come they're so slow? The ambulance ought to be here by now." On several occasions, he said of Colette, "She never hurt anyone," and added that the kids were great. He said he was awakened from sleep, Dr. Klein said. "I believe he was in the living room, sleeping on the sofa. He said he was awakened by somebody beating on him, and his wife was screaming, and there was a blonde female holding a candle, saying something like, 'Kill the pigs,' and there were three men, one of them a Negro. There was a man with a bat and a man with a knife, some sort of sharp instrument, and the man with the bat hit him, and somebody was jabbing at him with the sharp instrument, and he was dancing around trying to avoid them, and he said he could still hear his wife screaming. He mentioned something about his own wounds, that he'd seen a little bubble from his right chest, and I did not get the exact timing interval, but he said he examined his children. He said they didn't have any pulses, and that he went on to his wife. She had a lot of blood on her. He said she looked very bad. That was his statement. She looked very bad. He also said, "Be sure to tell the MPs and the CID, the Army's Criminal Investigation Division, that I pulled the knife that was in her chest out. Tell the MPs and the CID I pulled the knife from my wife's chest and threw it on the floor." The third doctor to see MacDonald was Merrill Bronstein, the staff surgeon on call, who had been awakened at home by a 4:45 a.m. call from the resident. Bronstein knew MacDonald from moonlighting work each had done in the emergency room of a civilian hospital in Fayetteville, and Bronstein had been extremely impressed by MacDonald, both as a person and as a physician. The relationship had not yet blossomed into close personal friendship, but once MacDonald had shown Bronstein a picture of one of his daughters on a pony he had bought them for Christmas, and more recently, in fact, within 10 days of February 17th, he had asked Bronstein, whose own wife was pregnant, to recommend an obstetrician for Colette. Stunned by the news of the murders, Bronstein arrived at the hospital shortly after 5 a.m. to assume responsibility for the care of Jeffrey MacDonald. "When I first came in," Bronstein said, "he was in a glass cubicle in the intensive care unit. He was tearful and very upset, continually asking where his family was. At one moment, talking about one thing, and at the next moment, talking about something else, but always very agitated. How could they do this to him? How could this have happened? What was this country coming to?" "I was concerned about his emotional status. That was the thing that affected me the most, the thing that impressed me the most, the thing that I had the greatest difficulty as a physician in dealing with. He was very upset, and I was very concerned for him. And because he was kind of hysterical, I thought I wanted him to be sedated. I wanted to give him a narcotic to relax him, and I wanted to give him a barbiturate to help him sleep. So I went over him thoroughly. I went over his scalp and hair, and I especially went over his reflexes. I did a neurological examination because generally, when a person has had a head injury, which I felt he had because he had a bruise and he said there had been times when he had lost consciousness, you withhold those drugs. So I did go over him very thoroughly, and then I gave him those drugs. I gave him a fair amount of them. I may have done it mainly for my own comfort. I mean, you know, it's no joke. I hate to see a grown man cry. 200 milligrams of the sedative Nembutal, a not insignificant amount, was administered intravenously at 5:30 a.m., at which time, according to the hospital nursing notes, Jeffrey MacDonald was hysterical and crying. 15 minutes later, 100 milligrams of the tranquilizer Vistaril were added. By 6 a.m., according to his chart, MacDonald was resting quietly. "But I never really accomplished what I intended," Bronstein said. "I mean, I never really knocked him out or made him incoherent in any way." As he had to the surgical resident, MacDonald described to Merrill Bronstein what had transpired at 544 Castle Drive. There was one detail which Bronstein recalled with particular clarity. "He told me at one point he had looked down at a man's hand and saw, he thought it was an ice pick. He told me to remind him to tell the FBI it was an ice pick. He said this several times. He remembered looking down and seeing a blade that looked like an ice pick, and he said to remind him to tell them about it." MacDonald also asked Bronstein to call his mother and his in-laws on Long Island and, without informing them of what had happened, to tell them to come to Fort Bragg right away. He made me promise to stay with him, to be with him when he told them what had happened. On the other hand, he wanted to know what had happened. One minute he would say that he wanted me to be with him when he told them what had happened, and yet he would ask me what had happened. He would continually ask, where was his wife? Where were the kids? Were they dead? Why weren't they here? Why wasn't I with them? He wanted me to be with them, yet he wanted me to go out and see what was going on. In other words, there was a question in my mind if he knew that his wife and children were dead. It was shortly after 5:30 a.m. when the phone rang at the home of Colette MacDonald's mother and stepfather, Mildred and Freddie Kassab. Mildred Kassab answered it. The caller identified himself as a doctor from Womack Hospital and asked to speak to her husband. "He's in the shower," Mildred Kassab said, "but you can tell me whatever it is. I'm not a hysterical person." "In that case," Merrill Bronstein said, "you'd better locate Captain MacDonald's mother and get down here as fast as you can." The first agent of the Army's Criminal Investigation Division to reach 544 Castle Drive on the morning of February 17th was William Ivory, who arrived just as Jeffrey MacDonald was being wheeled out the front door. Ivory was the CID agent on duty that night. He was 30 years old and had grown up in Somerville, Massachusetts, on the outskirts of Boston. Before becoming an Army detective, Ivory had worked for a while as a truck driver and then as a security guard at a Sylvania electronics plant. He was married and had two children of his own. Ivory had been dozing on a cot at CID headquarters when, shortly before 4 a.m., he had heard voices coming over the military police radio at what seemed a higher-than-normal pitch. There was a sense of urgency in the voices, which brought Ivory fully awake. When he heard the word stabbing, he went to the radio in his office and inquired of the MPs at the scene whether there had been any fatalities. Told that there had been, he gathered some evidence processing equipment, alerted the CID photographer, and drove to 544 Castle Drive. The streets were deserted. A light rain was falling. The ground was already wet from the heavy rain that had fallen earlier in the night. The temperature was not much above 40 degrees. Ivory reached the apartment at 4:10 a.m. There was, he noted, quite a stir in the neighborhood. People were coming to their doors, coming to the house to see what had happened. There were more than a dozen military policemen still clustered inside the apartment. Ivory stepped into the living room and was told what had happened by the lieutenant in charge. Looking down the hallway, Ivory could see the body of Colette MacDonald lying on the master bedroom floor. He walked to it. He got down on one knee. He studied the wounds to see if there was any active bleeding. There was not. He looked at the chest for signs of respiration. There were none. Whatever she had been for 26 years, she was now simply a battered, bloody corpse. Ivory noted the torn and bloody blue pajama top that had been laid across her chest and the white Hilton Hotel bath mat on her abdomen. He saw the word pig written in blood on the headboard. He saw the paring knife, a small wooden-handled knife with a bent blade and the brand name Geneva Forge stamped in the handle, lying not far from the body. By the feet of Colette MacDonald, he saw the pocket from the blue pajama top. This was only lightly flecked with blood. He saw a large stain, it looked like urine, on the exposed bottom sheet of the double bed. And he saw, rumpled together in a corner, the blood-soaked bedspread and top sheet from the bed. "Now I'll show you the children," the lieutenant said. Kimberly MacDonald's bedroom was dark. The lieutenant shined his flashlight on the bed. Ivory, using the tip of his pen so as not to blur any possible fingerprints, flipped on the light switch. He could see a bookcase filled with books and games, a child's record player sharing a tabletop with a collection of dolls, a Pink Panther piggy bank on a windowsill, and the body of 5-year-old Kimberly McDonald in her bed, her skull fractured, a piece of cheekbone protruding from her face, and the numerous gaping stab wounds in her neck. The process was repeated in the bedroom of Kristen McDonald, where, amid the gore, Ivory noted the bare, bloody footprint leading away from the girl's bed. Ivory went next door to use a neighbor's telephone. He called half a dozen CID agents and told each of them to call more. He also called the chief of the Fort Bragg CID, Franz Joseph Grebner. Then he asked the neighbors, a warrant officer, his wife, and 3 teenaged children, if they had heard any noise. Any sounds of a break-in, a fight, any disturbance at all? They said they had not. Ivory asked the warrant officer to accompany him next door to identify the bodies. "It's a pretty rough scene," he said, "but I'd appreciate it." In bathrobe and slippers, Jeffrey McDonald's next-door neighbor accompanied Ivory to 544 Castle Drive. The first time the neighbor had met McDonald had been in September, when McDonald had asked to borrow his lawnmower. The last time he'd been inside the apartment had been on a Christmas afternoon, when McDonald had invited him and his wife over for a drink. His 16-year-old daughter had been employed frequently by the McDonald's as a babysitter. He followed Ivory from room to room. "Yes," he said, "that's Chrissy." "Yes," he said, "that's Kim." "Yes," he said, "that's Mrs. McDonald." At that point, the CID photographer arrived. He did not stay long, however. He became nauseated at the sight of the bodies, and Ivory had to escort him from the scene. Ivory returned to the neighbor's house to again use the phone and request that the director of the CID photo lab come himself. In response to Ivory's calls, more agents began to arrive. Fort Bragg's chief law enforcement officer, the provost marshal, came to the scene with an assistant. Despite the raw chill in the air, the crowd of neighbors and bystanders grew larger. By the time Franz Joseph Grebner reached 544 Castle Drive, shortly after 5 a.m., there were so many people already there that he could not find a place to park his car. Once inside the apartment, Grebner received a briefing from Ivory. They knew only what they had seen and what McDonald had told the military police, that he'd been attacked by a group of hippies as he lay sleeping on his living room couch. Franz Joseph Grebner looked slowly around the living room. He had spent 19 years in CID and had seen a lot of crime scenes, and this one did not look to him the way it should. When one considered that it was an area in which a life-and-death struggle had taken place between a Green Beret officer and 4 intruders who had obviously been in some sort of murderous frenzy, and at least some of whom had been armed, there seemed remarkably few signs of disorder. A coffee table was tipped on its side next to the couch, its lower edge resting on a stack of magazines. An empty flower pot stood upright on the floor, its plant spilled out alongside it. A pair of eyeglasses with a speck of blood on an outer lens lay in a corner of the room. That was it. That was the sum total of the disarray. And in a dining area immediately adjacent to the living room, nothing at all had been disturbed. Plates remained balanced on edge in an unstable china cabinet, and Valentine cards still stood upright on a table. Grebner had been in poker games, which had left premises in worse condition. He called the CID laboratory at Fort Gordon, Georgia, and asked them to send a team of technicians to the scene. At 6 a.m., just as the first chilly gray light began to spread across the drizzly sky, 3 weapons were found: a blood-stained club, measuring 31 by 1 1/4 by 1 1/4 inches, lay just outside the back door. Two blue threads were stuck to it with blood. 20 feet away, lying side by side beneath a bush, were an ice pick and a second paring knife. This knife bore the trade name Old Hickory, and its blade was not bent, but straight. The blades of both the knife and ice pick, like the blade of the knife found on the bedroom floor, appeared to have been wiped clean of blood. At 8 a.m., medics arrived to remove the bodies of Jeffrey McDonald's wife and daughters. Kristen's body was lifted from its bed and placed on a stretcher in the hallway. The body of her sister was carried from the room across the hall and laid upon the same stretcher. A Catholic chaplain made the sign of the cross and spoke a few words of prayer. Then the medics lifted the stretcher and carried it out of the house. They returned with a separate stretcher for Colette. Using tongs, Ivory removed the bath mat from her abdomen and placed it in a plastic bag. Then, again using tongs, he lifted the torn and bloody blue pajama top from her chest. As he did, he could see that not only had the garment been ripped down the front along a seam, but that across the back there were dozens of neat, round holes. There would turn out to be 48 altogether, that looked as if they had been made with an ice pick. 3 hours earlier, Ivory had seen Jeffrey McDonald wheeled, apparently unconscious, to an ambulance. Dozens of ice pick holes in the back of his pajama top, Ivory assumed, meant dozens of ice pick holes in his back. Ivory immediately dispatched an agent to Womack Hospital with instructions to interview McDonald as soon as possible, in an attempt to get a better description of the intruders and a more detailed account of the attack. Indeed, Ivory feared that it might already be too late. He did not think it likely that a man with that many wounds was going to survive for very long. Then, with the pajama top sealed inside a plastic bag, Ivory watched as medics lifted the body of Colette McDonald from the floor. She had been dead long enough by this time for the process of rigor mortis to have begun. Her neck and the upper portion of her body had grown rigid. As the medics lifted her by the shoulders and legs, her head did not slump backward, and Ivory, who was standing close by, saw directly beneath her head a dark clot of blood about the size of his fist, and sticking up from the clot, pigtail fashion, something which appeared to be a thread, a blue thread. He got down on his hands and knees and removed the thread from the blood clot with tweezers and placed it in a plastic vial. Then, looking within the body outline that he had drawn with yellow magic marker on the rug, he noticed more threads, perhaps as many as 2 dozen altogether. These threads were not microscopic. They ranged in length from 1 to 2.5 inches, and all appeared identical to those used in the manufacture of the torn blue pajama top that had been found on Colette McDonald's chest. This immediately struck William Ivory as peculiar. He could not understand how, if, as seemed obvious, the torn blue pajama top had been placed on top of Colette McDonald's body after it had come to rest on the floor, so many threads from it could have wound up underneath. During the next hour, Ivory continued to gather evidence. He soon discovered additional blue threads. There would turn out to be 81 altogether, scattered across the entire room. 2 were even found beneath the headboard of the bed, where the word pig had been written in blood. Ivory also found 2 pieces of latex rubber on the rug. 1 was the size of a dime, the other the size of a quarter. They looked like they might have come from a rubber glove. A few minutes later, as he unfolded the pile of bloody bedding that lay in the corner of the master bedroom, he found a finger section of a disposable rubber surgeon's glove. The section seemed to have been torn at its base, as might happen if one were removing such a glove in a hurry. Also, it was stained, as if some